It's 6 minutes after 9 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. Kathleen will be back next week. Well, listen to this lead from a story in the New York Times earlier this week. In a few weeks, the Treasury Department's czar of executive pay will have to answer this $100 million question. Should Andrew J. Hall get his bonus? Well, I'm sure we all remember the huge flap caused by the AIG bonuses last winter. What do you think will happen if Citigroup pays Andrew J. Hall what they owe him by contract, assuming the Treasury Department's executive pay czar allows the deal to go through? It's a more complex question than you might think. And there are other questions emerging as unintended consequences of last year's financial industry bailout. We're going to talk about some of those paradoxes this morning, and to help us sort through them, I'm joined by Charles Elson, the Edgar S. Willard, Jr. Chair of the John L. Weinberg Center for Corporate Governance at Lehmer College of Business and Economics at the University of Delaware. Good morning, Professor Elson, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, and good to be with you this morning.
Well, after the AIG bonus scandal, if scandal is the right word, President Obama created the post of executive pay czar to prevent future AIG-type incidents from occurring. Was this a good idea, or was this some sort of misguided attempt to appease the public?
Well, I think I'd put it in the second category. It's interesting. You know, the idea of someone reviewing pay and passing judgment on pay outside the company is actually not a new one. The courts have had the power to reduce pay for years, really dating back to the 1930s when the Supreme Court ruled that any compensation that wasn't related to services rendered to a company was waste and actionable by a shareholder and reducible by a judge. But back then, in that particular case, the judge ultimately refused to get involved. Said, though I have the power to do this, how do I know what someone is worth or isn't worth? I'm not there. I'm not close to the situation. And frankly, it's better for the board, elected by the shareholders, to make that judgment as to what someone's worth or not worth. And from that opinion all the way to the present, judges have been extremely reluctant, really except in case of fraud, to get involved in the compensation arena. And the reason being that they say, we're outside. How do we know any better than someone inside on what the right thing to pay is? And what they've really focused on was the motivation of those negotiating. Was the board independent of management? Was the board sufficiently advised when it made its pay determinations? And in other words, the procedure as opposed to the result. And I think the kind of same thing applies here. As, you know, talented as Mr. Feinberg is, how is he any better than someone on the board of the company or the owners of the company, if you really will, deciding what someone should be paid or shouldn't be paid? Does he have any special skills? Does he have the crystal ball as to what someone has done or hasn't done? And the answer is no. It's just, and particularly if you take his task and multiply it by multiple companies through multiple industries with multiple stories, I think it's an impossible task. And as I said, who's to say he's any better than they are? And unfortunately, either he goes along with the pay they're proposing, which leads him open to charges of simply allowing an egregious pay package to continue, or he cuts the pay. Let's say the person leaves the company, and then the board says, you've ruined this for the shareholders. This person has left, and we won't be able to make as much money for the government, the taxpayers, or our investors. Either way, he loses. It's a really lousy place to be, and I think it was, unfortunately, a great idea for public relations purposes, but a lousy idea if your goal is to really get the pay problem fixed.
Well, and in this case, the case of Andrew Hall, this wasn't a bonus. It's his share of the profits from a whole bunch of oil speculation that he was very successful at, and he's with actually a company called Philbro, which is a small commodities trading firm. That's kind of a subsidiary of Citigroup, and that's who his contract is with, and they owe him the money. So, you know, it's I don't know. This is the kind of thing that is easy to exploit if you're trying to point the finger at people making too much money. But it's once you actually read what's going on, it makes a whole lot more sense.
Absolutely, and that's the difficulty with the Pazar. I mean, ultimately, the company he's with was originally independent, and I think part of Salomon Brothers, and eventually ended up in Citicorp. And it had value to it. It was the trading operations there produced large profits, I would assume, I would hope, or they wouldn't have kept the thing. And, as part of his deal, obviously, that he would get something from what he generated for the unit. That was the decision of the folks who ran Citigroup, and the decision, obviously, the board of Citigroup that would allow the folks who managed it to keep on managing it. And the question was their judgment off? Well, having someone outside review it, different story. If the shareholders of Citigroup said, forget it, we're replacing, getting a different board, lousy decision, that would be one thing. But having someone outside, it's actually interesting, too. This isn't someone who's been appointed by the president and confirmed by Congress. There's not an official office of the pay person. In fact, if you think about it, it's kind of amusing. They call this fellow the pay czar. Well, czar is not exactly a U.S. business term. It came from somewhere else. And the whole concept is a little strange because it's, where is the accountability there? I don't know. Government has a good chunk of Citigroup, but so do a lot of other people. Citigroup is still owned significantly by public shareholders. And what happens are his interests and the interests of the administration coincident with the interest of the shareholders? And that's the real long-term problem of this whole area. Because, if you can say, okay, the government's interest and the shareholders' interests are aligned, they're the same thing, they're moving in the same direction, but they're not. The government is a political entity. And frankly, you get a lot of hay out of saying, this guy shouldn't be paid his $100 million. And it's a big number, and it's, to anyone, that's an enormous, enormous number. And it's a scary number, and it's a number that raises a lot of hackles. But if you say, okay, not entitled to it, goodbye. Let's say the fellow picks up and leaves. And let's say the fellow actually made a lot of money for the company. Ultimately, the government gets the political score, because the person has left, and they've done the right thing for pay, supposedly, yet on the shareholder side, the shareholders lose because ultimately a profit generator has disappeared. Now, for the government, the downside is nothing because as a political entity, they really couldn't care less how much money they made or don't make. It's a political body. It's there designed to get votes. On the shareholder side, they care deeply because if, in fact, the person disappears, then the value of their investment goes down. The interesting thing is there seems to be this dichotomy that's been created between taxpayers and investors, a split. Well, taxpayers on one side, investors on the other. But it's really today a kind of a false dichotomy because today, all investors obviously are taxpayers, but frankly, most taxpayers are investors, whether through our individual investments, our 401ks, our retirement plans, our pension plans. We're all in this. And anything that damages the value to investors, that damages, frankly, society generally. And the real danger is if you stick it to the investors enough times, they stop investing. And if they stop investing and the values go down, no one gets to retire. And the government then will have to then pick everyone up. The question is, where's the tax revenue for the government if you destroy the enterprises that produce the wealth that produces the taxes? It's kind of a strange but sad situation.
Well, I think I referred to this as the law of unintended consequences operating perfectly. There was a lot of anger. I mean, people were hurting, and it's pretty easy when you've got a situation like that to pick out someone or some group of people and point to them and say, there, it's their fault. They did this to us. Let's go get them. And pretty soon you've got pitchforks and torches, and people are around the castle. But it seems to me, and I hope that one of the things we can do in this program is to maybe look a little deeper, look behind this. In particular, when you talked about, at some point, the shareholders, the people who invest money, are just going to say, hey, you know what? We keep getting beat by this system. We're not going to put our money here anymore, and it's going to go somewhere else, and then we're all in trouble. I'd like to have us expand on that just a little bit. So what happened in that case? None of us can retire, but there would be a lot of other consequences if people stopped investing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you'd basically, the capital system would stop, and you would have, it would mean the cost of creating new businesses and new wealth would be incredibly expensive, because equity capital, that is, when people invest in a company stock, is a lot cheaper for a company than having to go out and borrow money from others. Equity is, you're always, if you can do it, a great way to raise financing. And if suddenly equity disappears, then, in fact, it's going to be a lot harder to start new businesses. And, frankly, new businesses create the growth that is going to get us out of this mess. I mean, you know, it's interesting. On the university side of things, the endowments drop because the value of their investments drop. The university has problems, but then the professors at universities who have their retirement funds and large pension funds, when those things which invest in equities fall in value, then they say, okay, can't retire now because my retirement isn't there, so I've got to keep working. And if they keep working at a university that has less money to pay out, number one, they don't retire. They don't retire. New people can't come into the system and teach at those universities, which means suddenly you have a whole new generation of folks who don't get jobs. So what do they do? Any time you throw a rock into the water, the reverberations go way beyond where the rock went in. I think that's been the problem, whether it's the Pazar issue or the, government takeover, if you will, of a system of capital formation or restrictions on the ability of companies to raise capital. It's an unintended consequence. It sounds great, terrific sound bites that, we're going to stick it to the people who, took too much money out. And that's not to say there wasn't a problem. There was a huge problem on overcompensation. A lot of people were making money at ridiculous levels. The investment banks were paying out like 50% of their earnings as compensation to their employees. That is way beyond any other public company. It's a strange business model. That's a problem. The question is, how do you solve it? And you solve it through effectively nationalizing the businesses? Do you solve it by taking large stakes in those businesses? I don't think so. There's a different way to do it, and it has to do with invigorating investors who own the thing to take responsibility for what these companies are doing and force change.
We're at a break, and we need to pause for just a moment. When we come back, we've got some people who want to join us and talk about this issue. If you are one of them, please give us a call, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. That's the toll-free number that's good just about anywhere that you can hear the program. You can also send an email. The email address is talk@WPR.org. We're talking about some of the paradoxes that were created by the financial bailout, the bailout of the financial industry, I should say, by the federal government, and that means us, and the things that are happening now that were at least in part a result of that, the a reaction to executive compensation, the creation of the compensation czar in the Treasury Department. We're discussing that. We are going to also talk about some of the other paradoxes that were created. The Securities and Exchange Commission suing a subsidiary of a bank that got TARP money. So if they end up paying a fine, they may be paying it out of with the money they got in the bailout. So there are some interesting paradoxes that have been created by our reaction to the financial calamity that we saw in the last couple of years. We're going to be talking about those, and if you'd like to join the discussion, again, the number 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and the email address talk@WPR.org. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 21 after 9, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's what's coming up a little bit later on the Ideas Network. Are we humans wired to cooperate? After 3, Jean Faraca's guest makes her case on Here on Earth. It's based on her study of the social and caretaking activities of our great ape ancestors. Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders, after 3 o'clock this afternoon, here on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about, well, a variety of things, but in general, some of the conundrums and paradoxes created by our reaction, at least in part, to the financial meltdown in the United States, which we're still getting over. And one of the things that happened sort of as a piece of fallout from all of that was the creation of a compensation czar in the Treasury Department. And that person's got a pretty tough decision to make regarding someone who is with a subsidiary of Citigroup, who is by contract and because of outstanding performance owed a portion of profits from oil futures trading. It's a $100 million bonus, and there will be some questions about it. And then there are also some other paradoxes that have been created. My guest to help us sort through all of this this morning is Charles Elson, who is the Edgar S. Wood Jr. Chair of the John L. Weinberg Center for Corporate Governance at Lehmer College of Business and Economics at the University of Delaware. How do you fit all that on a business card?
It takes a lot of small print and some good eyes.
Yeah, and you probably don't have a logo polo shirt with that on it either. I wouldn't think.
Yeah, we tried actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Man,
if we didn't put all those names on, either Mr. Willard or Mr. Weinberg wouldn't be too happy, or Mr.
Well, Porter. You know, I'd like a polo shirt like that. Got one in 3X.
we can try.
Okay, well, I'm kidding. Anyway, well, now I completely lost my train of thought. Let's take a phone call while I gather what's left of my wits. We'll go to Tom in Burlington next.
Good morning.
Tom, good morning.
I'd just like to say something very quickly. The first paradox that we're operating under, the general paradox, is this. It started way back when we're natives dancing around a fire. The medicine man was the guy who told you that he knows everything and he can solve all these problems, and he's the expert. And from that time on, right now we've continued with that same thought. We give everything to these experts and we pay them more than they really deserve or need or are worth. And so as long as the so-called expert and tells you that he knows everything and there's nobody else that can do what he can do, then we'll keep this paradox of thinking. Now, my feeling is that they tell you that if you don't give me all this money, if I don't rob your treasury, I will go someplace else and rob somebody else's treasury. And the pay scale that these people are getting is incredibly out of line from what they deserve or what they're worth. And we're operating under this mental idea that this guy's the only guy who knows the voodoo and he knows how to do this. The next point I'd just quickly like to make is that my feeling is that if we level the playing field and these prices would level off, the executive pay would level off if we got in there and said, okay, this is the rule that we're going to use in this company, and the thing would come down to a level because economics always brings things down to a level. The next point is this, is that I forgot my point here.
Compensation.
Oh, here's the point. The point is this. When you sign a contract with someone, there is a clause in that contract that says, if any part of this contract is fraudulent or deceitful or whatever, this entire contract is over with. Now, if we're going to solve this problem going forward, it should be a part of everyone's contract, and the government says this is the contract. If this company fails for some reason or other, and it's connected to something, your contract is null and void, or we start over, or we start from something, because you can put anything into a contract you want, and if both parties agree, then that's the contract. So that's just all I'm going to put out there today.
Well, thanks, Tom. Of course, we all know what happens to the medicine man if he can't bring rain.
That's true. Well, you know, it makes a good point. I think that what the whole thing showed us was that the folks on Wall Street who said they were the smartest guys in the room really weren't that smart, or were not as smart as they told us they were. And the question is, why should they have gotten paid what they got paid? And I think he's right. The salaries there are out of whack. And some of these numbers are bizarre. The question, though, is how do you fix it? And is it someone out, some third party saying this is bizarre enough? Or would you rather have the board of directors or the management of the company in negotiation attempting to determine what in fact is fair? Because, as easy it is to attack high compensation, It's not high compensation that's the issue. It's overcompensation. That is money that wasn't earned. It wasn't deserved. And the solution to that is better bargaining by the negotiator, not someone coming in and setting a price. That's why housing prices are not set by a government authority or a third authority. They're set by the marketplace. What you know, someone wants a house, someone has a house to sell. And what they agree on in the middle is the value of the thing. But to say, well, you know, every time you're going to sell your house, we're going to have a third party out there, a house reviewer, and tell you whether it's fair or not, whether you can sell or not, would effectively stop the market for housing completely. Because people would say, you know, those who are selling say, if this person says it's too low, forget it, I'm not selling it. And then someone who wants the house is stuck too, because it's not for sale. I mean, ultimately, the market on compensation does work, but you have to ensure that it works effectively. And the question is, how do you do it? And I don't see, you know, a pay czar effectively, or like I didn't see a judge years ago setting it. It's got to be, the key is effective negotiation. And you get at that, I think, through people on boards of these companies that are linked to the investors.
Well, let's talk about the boards, for example, for a moment, because it seems to me that a lot of these people were really asleep at the switch.
Totally. I agree with you. They were.
There was a lot of undue influence on the part of some of these CEOs on the boards. It was like they were all these relationships, and this may be an inappropriate term, but these relationships seemed rather incestuous.
They were. And, you know, that the boards in a lot of these places really weren't independent of management. And so they were not really representative of shareholder interests, but were representative of managerial interests. And I think that clouded their judgment and, frankly, made it impossible really to do their job effectively. But the solution to that is not, again, the pay czar. The solution to that is creating boards of directors who are, number one, independent of management, number two, have real equity stakes, ownership stakes in the company, and number three, are subject to a vibrant election process that if they mess up, they get replaced. But that doesn't happen. The election process traditionally didn't happen, and these folks traditionally weren't independent, and traditionally they didn't have a lot of equity. Now, the administration has proposed in Congress, and I think passed the House, a measure that would require independence on the part of compensation committees of the boards, which is not a bad start. But they left off the other two sort of important factors, which are A, ownership by the directors to link their interest with the shareholders, and B, a more vibrant election. Interesting thing about it, though, the state law, and the Delaware particular, I'm in Delaware, and we just changed our law as of last week, to create more vibrant elections, and our law has always pushed director independence and director ownership. And those three things coming from the state, I think, ultimately solve the problem. But again, it's you have to think of boards that are independent of management, boards that have a lot of equity in the company, and finally, boards that are subject to real elections.
Well, a lot of people want to talk about this issue, so let's go back to the phones and take a call from Roger in Sauk County next. Roger, good morning.
Good morning. I never followed this company by company, but I've heard it through the news enough. We were told, you know, most of these companies were about to go bankrupt if they didn't get the bailout money from the United States government, us. So, in my opinion, I know this is really simple, doesn't make for a long contract, is those companies should operate and all contracts should stand as if the company went bankrupt, and then go forward with this influx of money from the government. Any thoughts?
Well, that's a good one. You know, the problem is until you're bankrupt, you're not bankrupt. And I think the idea was the government put money in to avoid it, because in bankruptcy, you know, everything gets basically scrambled, and the fear is in bankruptcy the business itself disappears. Hence the, you know, desire to, you know, keep GM and Chrysler out of, you know, initially out of bankruptcy. As it turns out, bankruptcy is actually not a bad process. You can sort things out pretty cleverly in bankruptcy, and that's why we have bankruptcy. And maybe it would have been effective to have let some of these people actually disappear. But I think the government believed, and I think the market believed, that to do so in the financial system would be catastrophic to the, not just to the system itself, but to, you know, everyone who depended on the system, which is all of us. And so they kept it out of bankruptcy. We have a sort of a saying in the law biz that says good cases make bad law. In other words, a case where you say, you know, this is really terrible, we got to do something about it. You may do something about it, but the collateral effects may be disastrous for everyone else. And I think, you know, if you treated the companies that weren't in bankruptcy as if, in fact, they were, and abrogated the contracts, that would be a real problem. Look at the Chrysler-GM thing, actually. I mean, that's kind of an interesting one, too, because that's one of those situations where they actually went into bankruptcy. And in bankruptcy, the monies that that were lent to these companies from private creditors were effectively wiped out. Now, typically, the credit people lend the money to the thing get first dibs on the assets. And after they've gotten what they've paid out, then whatever's left is split up amongst the shareholders. In the case of Chrysler and GM, the creditors were wiped out, and effectively, I think the U.S. government, which was a creditor, and the workers of the company took the equity out of the thing, and basically, as we say in the law business, subordinated the creditors who got quite a bit less. Well, sounds, you know, good case. Hey, you know these people, you know, this is for the greater good, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But ultimately, what happens in that? This is where I say good cases make bad law. Down the road, you're going to make it a lot harder for anyone to access credit because no one's going to lend if they realize, hey, I lend, and basically I get nothing. The contract isn't that I had with the company is not upheld in bankruptcy, and I lose. Therefore, either I don't lend, or if I do lend, I'm going to lend at 70% interest to ensure I'll get something paid back very quickly, which would be disastrous for companies trying to raise money. Same thing in the comp area. If you said, okay, the comp contract is no good. We're going to pretend you're in bankruptcy, and you're down the line. You're not going to get anything. First of all, in bankruptcy, employees always get paid first. By the way, I mean employment contracts. These kinds of things are the first to get paid. The employees get out first, so they probably would have been paid anyway. But let's say you said, "Yeah, you're not going to pay them. You know, you're going to subordinate them." Then, in fact, the contract would be worthless, and at some point, people would stop making contracts, which ultimately harmful to the system long term. And that's why I think you have to, well, some things may make you feel good. It's like, you know, getting out and you know, screaming into the woods. You know, it might make you feel a little better, but, you know, ultimately, you got to make sure that you don't ruin everyone else's eardrums. You've got to have a good purpose coming out of it. I just think ultimately that wouldn't have gotten solved the problem. That's a good question, though. Good thought.
Well, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Jim in Waukesha. Jim, good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I would like to know, this shouldn't be that complicated, but when you look at Forbes 400 and you look at the incredible wealth of some of the richest people in the United States, they said in 2006 their combined wealth was $750 billion, then it went to $1.54 trillion. And then on top of the shareholders and stuff, really what it comes down to is valuation of labor in this country. You take Walmart, for example, people don't I think there's 1 million employees for Walmart, 70% of which are part-time, no health care. The consumer thinks they're getting a deal by shopping at Walmart because they see the shelf price, but in essence, through Badger Care or whatever, or care for the Walmart employees, like the state of California had to allocate $88 million. But then the top Walmart, or the Waltons, were 15.7 each. That's a millionaire 15,700 times over at the expense of labor. Now, why, when it comes to these market managers and stuff like that, why isn't there a reality show to show what they actually do? And what they do is siphon the laborer's wages without decent compensation, salary, no more pensions, no more vacation time, especially through temp agencies, and what percentage of people are working for temp agencies. Nothing allocated to a future pension, earned vacation time, personal time, health care. It's just coveting my neighbor's property. And what we need is a reality show to show what these business guys on Wall Street are actually doing to, achieve all this money.
Yeah. Well, Jim, I think we get it. Let's have our guest respond. So what is it these high-priced executives are doing to earn all this money?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I mean, that's, you know, again, you go back to, you know, negotiating with someone. What are they? What is their efforts worth to them? What's it worth to you? And that's why you need a board that effectively negotiates with them on salary. And if they, in fact, the idea would be an executive, theoretically, runs a large organization, steers the organization in an appropriate way and delivers profits for the corporation and good salaries for the workers. I mean, you know, there's always been this sort of argument out there that if shareholders profit, workers lose. And I always found it kind of a strange argument. Again, one of these things, it sounds good, but if you kind of look behind it a little bit, it doesn't quite bear itself out. Because if you pay employees badly, treat your employees badly for a long period of time, no one will come to work for you. Basically, you will not get the kind of employees you want to make the operation run effectively. If, let's say, a retailer paid its employees miserably, at some point, the employees who get paid miserably take it out on the customer, and the customer stops coming in. I mean, take a look at the airlines sometimes. You know, people aren't very happy working in those places. They let you know. It makes it a very unpleasant experience. And, you know, ultimately, you can't run a show that way, particularly in a retailer, a competitive business. If you pay your employees too little and they hate working for you and they either don't work for you or those who do don't like working for you, they let their customers know that. And eventually the customers will go to another operation that pays its employees better and are happy to be there. So ultimately, extracting shareholder profit through, you know, keeping wages too low ultimately kills the business and ultimately kills shareholder profit. It has to be a balance. You have to, again, with any sort of employee, whether management or the rank and file, you got to pay someone fairly, and you can't overpay someone. And ultimately, that creates a stronger business and ultimately creates greater profits. But then the bigger question is, well, who are the shareholders? You know, is that some, you know, just, you know, some rich folks hanging around Wall Street? And the answer is no. The answer, unfortunately, for us is it's all of us through our retirement funds and whatnot. We own all these companies. The success of these companies are vital to everyone in this country because we all happen to be in it. It's kind of humorous. I always ask my students, do you realize what group of people, if you had to pick a profession that has more power on Wall Street than anyone else, who would you pick? And you get all kinds of good answers. You know, oh, they're the lawyers, the this, the that, the bankers. And the answer is no. The largest pension fund, equity holding fund in the country, is called TIA Cref. It's owned by, it's a retirement fund of university teachers. And it's always kind of funny, you go around college campus and you say, do you know who the most powerful guys on Wall Street are? We are, you know, it's our fund. And that fund invests in everything, including large retailers and companies that operate everywhere. And so, you know, if they do well, we do well. The secret is, and society does well, the secret is how do you create effective oversight over management so they don't run the company in a sloppy manner, and they don't run a company in a manner, let's say, that exploits the employees so that long-term they will not remain profitable operations. It all relates. You know, you can't, again, it's like throwing a stone in the water. The waves go in all kinds of directions. And, you know, there's a lot of, quote, simple solutions out there, but you got to think, I think, these things 10 steps ahead. And I agree that a lot of executives, a lot of companies are overpaid. And I think the fault of that, and it comes from comes from the board itself. I don't really believe that the overpayment to these people is money out of the pockets of the employees. I think that's, you know, given the amounts, that's a little bit simplistic. But I do think it's money that belonged to the investors, which happen to be the employees too. Right, because most employees own stock in their companies. So that's why I said, you know, the employees versus management is kind of or employees versus investors is a really strange argument that if you really bear down in it, isn't quite as it would say was 50 years ago with investment, with everyone.
Well,
you know, investing.
I don't want to debate the point too long here, but I'm trying to remember the name of the company. I think it was Costco. Was pilloried on Wall Street because they took too good care of their employees. At the same time, Walmart was the darling, and they weren't doing anywhere near as much for their rank and file, if you will. And so, you know, investors sometimes take a dim view of employee compensation where they don't seem to question how much the CEO gets. And my point remains, what is it that this person is doing? Because you saw all of these CEOs that were making these huge amounts of money in companies that were failing.
Correct.
I mean, the company's going down the tubes, and here's somebody who's walking away with a 7, 8, or 9-figure bonus.
I think it's obscene. I agree. I think the way you compensate these people is you give them some cash, but I think you make the bulk of their compensation in company stock, company equity, and then they will rise or fall with the company with the impact value of the company. If they produce results, then the stock price will reflect that, and they'll do well. If they don't, the stock price will reflect that, and they'll walk off with nothing. I mean, one of the interesting things about the failures of some of these banks, whether it was Lehman Brothers or Bear Stearns, is that the executives in that company had a vast chunk of their net worth tied up in these things, and they basically lost either, well, not everything, but almost everything. I mean, billions of dollars. So in a way, they did eat their own cooking, and they suffered the consequences thereof. But I think that it's the design of the compensation system that ultimately brings this whole thing into line. But I agree with you, anyone who gets a bonus when a company's failing, it's ridiculous. But if you design the compensation around stock ownership, it changes the ballpark dramatically. Now, as to the point on, you know, investors, you know, liking companies that pay people less and whatnot, you know, again, in the short term, there may be mistakes made by investors, but over the long haul, investors generally tend to get it right over 4 or 5 years. Ultimately, if you underpay people, you're going to get less motivated employees, and you're not going to, and for a business that is dependent on their employees as the face of the public, that's a real issue, because ultimately you're going to go to a place that treats you well as a customer, and the people working there are A, not qualified because the company doesn't pay them very much, or B, unhappy about working there. They're going to take it out on your customers, and ultimately you won't have much of a business.
Of course, if you ran everybody else out of town first, it wouldn't matter because you could just find more employees.
That's the theory, but, you know, competition is funny. You know, at some point, you know, I'm always a big believer, you know, in pendulums kind of moving one direction or the other. If you get bad enough service, someone will reappear. Either a big box will show up, or, better yet, a small person will compete with you in your various departments. Someone will come in and take this part of your business away or that part of your business. People shop on price and where they're treated well. And if you treat people badly enough, long enough, they stop going. And there have been stores that, you know, I've had that experience in. And it's interesting where I've noticed in an industry where and I know from an investor standpoint that they've really cut their labor costs out. I go in there and it's a horrible experience. And I'll go to the competitors. I'll say, forget it. I'm not going to be treated this way. And ultimately, it happens enough times to enough people, their business disappears. Think of the numbers of businesses over the years, retailers that no longer exist. And if you think about it, they always usually have one thing in common. They didn't treat their people particularly well. And I think that's whether it's a retailer or any other industry. There's got to be a balance. I also think that you've got to include your employees in the ownership of the business, too. I mean, I think the employees need to be shareholders in the companies they work for. It gives them a real stake in the company, real motivation to do a decent job. And a nice chance to realize real growth in their savings through their own efforts if the company's successful.
We need to take a break. When we come back, we'll take a bunch more phone calls between now and the top of the hour. Thanks for joining us today. We'll get to your calls in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:46. Here's what's coming up at the top of the hour. Last month, an object, possibly a comet, slammed into the planet Jupiter, leaving a mark the size of the Pacific Ocean. Now imagine what would happen if something like that hit Earth. Well, it may be a better chance than you think. We'll talk about that after the news at the top of the hour. This hour, we're talking about, the genesis of the conversation is a situation that the Treasury's new pay czar is going to have to confront in relationship to $100 million that's owed to someone who traded oil futures for a subsidiary of Citigroup. And it's a lot more complicated than that, but we only have another 14 minutes of program left. So we're talking about kind of the issue here is executive pay and who should decide who gets how much money. My guest is Charles Elson, the Edgar S. Willard Jr. Chair at the John L. Weinberg Center for Corporate Governance at Lehmer College of Business and Economics at the University of Delaware. There, I said it all in one breath. Let's just say that that Professor Elson is an expert in executive compensation. Let's go back to the phones and take a call from Louie in Wausau. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I'd like both the host and guest to comment on this idea proposed by Felix Rohatyn, the purpose of which is to take volatility out of the market and also to skew executive compensation towards something more beneficial to us all. And his proposal was to change the tax laws so that short-term capital gains, say 30 days and less, would be taxed at 90% or even 100%, and that rate would fall off to zero in about 8 years, and also that rates for dividends would be more favorable than for capital gains, leading executives to pay themselves with dividends rather than capital gains.
You know, that's an interesting idea. I hadn't heard that. I mean, I've always been a big proponent, of frankly, dividend tax rates being comparable to capital gains. Traditionally, capital gains are treated, much more lightly, than dividends, which were treated as ordinary income. And I thought that what that did was it basically pushed companies not to pay out their earnings in dividends and share with their investors, but kept it in the company itself, sometimes used for rather dubious projects with the idea that in the end, the investor gets it out through the capital gain, through the sale of the stock. And I've always thought that, forcing someone to sell a share of stock to take their gain out really wasn't right, that it really ought to come out in the terms of dividend payouts on earnings. And I think it's intriguing that he would cut, first of all, the dividend rate below the capital gain rate. On the capital gain point, I can kind of see that, but I'm not so sure that that's the greatest idea, too. I would agree that long-term gain rates should be lower than the ordinary income rates. I think that's a smart move. Ultimately, the business makes money. The business pays taxes on that money that it makes. And a gain tax is effectively, I think it penalizes investment, which is a good thing. And I think ultimately the government does get its due through taxation on the earnings of the business on a daily basis. But discriminating between long-term gains and short-term gains, which actually we've done for a long time. I mean, long-term gain and short-term gains in some areas were taxed differently. I don't know if it really solves the problem. Because think of it this way, the share of stock itself, no matter who buys it, is perpetual. The idea is to encourage long-term thinking in the business. And the way you do that is I don't think through a change in the capital gains rates, but a requirement that the executives in the business who get equity be required to hold the equity through their term in office. And in other words, if they get the stock, they've got to keep it for 10, 15 years as long as they're at the company. And ultimately, I think that forces long-term perspective in the business itself. And I think I'd rather see that as a solution than going back to sort of monkeying with the rates. But I do agree with him that the capital gains rates, I think a 90% capital gain rate on a short-term profit is a little excessive if you think about it. Because there are people who trade, and some people argue that trading is not a bad thing for the market. It creates liquidity. It means that if, let's say, you've held your stock for 20 years and you decide it's time to exit, at which, by the way, you'd be taxed at a lower rate, there's someone who's there to buy it from you. And if you make it more difficult to trade, then it's going to be the value of your share when sold is going to be a bit less because there isn't the marketplace that you need. So I understand the theory, but I think there's a better way to handle it. A, reducing taxes on dividend rates, and B, requiring executives to hold the stock long term. But again, he's a brilliant guy, and anything he says is certainly worth sitting and thinking about.
Well, another wise man once said, in the long run, we'll all be dead.
this is true.
Mike in Milwaukee, you're next.
Hi. I don't think I agree with your guest that we should just allow these bonuses to be paid because there were contracts. I think I'd like to hear discussion as to how this gentleman, I don't know, this trader, was his name Saul or whatever his name is, made $100 million. And I'd like some discussion as to where the money came from that resulted in these profits. It came from all of us in paying high gas prices last summer. He was allowed, he and people like him, were allowed to manipulate the price of oil so that the price was $4 a gallon or more, and we were all paying for this guy's bonus. This is manipulation of commodities futures, which wasn't allowed in the past as it is now. There's a good article in Rolling Stones about Goldman Sachs, which discusses this. I personally would like the czar to say, no, you're not getting your bonus, and congressional hearings held with this particular guy as a witness so that all the people in the United States can understand how this guy made $100 million. There's been no discussion as to what he did to make this money. He manipulated all of us. I'll listen to the comments.
Well, you know, I mean, the question is, you know, I don't know what he did to earn the $100 million either, and I guess that's what the czar will look at. But, you know, again, if the board effectively negotiated with him and that's what they did, that's unfortunately, for better or not, what you would show them. Again, it sounds great to say this guy got this much and doesn't deserve it and let's just throw it out. Well, again, good cases make bad law. Yeah, you might throw it out in that particular instance, but if you destroy the value of a contract, ultimately we'll all pay because, frankly, without contracts, there'll be a rather different way of doing business, which would, I think, be much more expensive for all of us.
Well, in this case,
I don't know what, you know, on the oil markets, you know, I don't know what happened or didn't happen and what this individual trader did or didn't do, because I frankly was unaware of what he was trading. So I it's hard for me to comment on that, but maybe you've got an idea.
Well, I've got the New York Times article in front of me, and Mike, if you want to check this out, it's an article by David Segal from Monday, August 3rd, 2009, and it outlines in great detail what Mr. Hall did. Apparently, he's got a long track record as being brilliant in the commodities area, and this $100 million looks to me from reading the article as almost a commission, because he made a whole lot more than that for his employers. And clearly, if he's denied his bonus, he's an extremely wealthy man, owns a castle in Europe where he keeps thousands of pieces of art, I guess. I don't know. And he will just take his expertise someplace else. And in fact, I think part of his company is in Great Britain. So he'll just take his expertise somewhere else and continue trading. And Citigroup will be denied his talent and will make less money.
Well, I think it's an interesting point, too. Someone recently made, they said, if the rules get too tough, the way organizations today are set up, corporations are set up, they're multinational, and they'll just pick up and leave the United States. I mean, and they will move their headquarters somewhere else and subject themselves to a different jurisdiction, and will basically be left with the dregs. It's not that hard to do, and it's not as though we can prevent that from happening. And that's a real problem, too. And then I think as a country, which is a country that has tremendous wealth and tremendous talent and ability, basically self-destructing, which would be really pretty sad, given what we've worked to create over all these years.
Let's take a quick call from Steve in Madison. Steve,
Hi.
Good morning.
Hi, thanks. I don't think the Delaware corporation laws are liable to be any check on management compensation, because they've gotten the lion's share of corporation fees by having weak corporation laws, and I think any requirement that directors own stock is liable to be kind of a fig leaf. They get that stock as a gift from management, and I don't think that the idea that they're going to have real elections is going to be anything substantial.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The Delaware corporate law is almost identical to the corporate law of every other state, with a few exceptions here and there. And some actually believe that Delaware, its law, is more protective of investors, believe it or not. The question is how you interpret it. And for a long time, the view of Delaware, I think, Delaware's always been an investor-protective state, but their view was, historically, that management is the best steward of shareholder value. And I think that view turned out to be incorrect. And I think that the law, the interpretation of the law, has really changed over the last 10 years. Delaware just recently changed a statute to allow in shareholder elections the reimbursement of dissident candidates, effectively. If you run for office and you knock out an incumbent director, you can get your expenses paid for by the company. That's a pretty big deal, because what that does is it makes the threat of a real election viable to directors, and it forces directors to be more accountable to the shareholders who elect them than the managers who, you're right, initially did appoint them. But if the shareholders can knock you out, it shifts the balance, and the company can pay for it. It shifts the balance of power. I think that, combined with independence and ownership, creates a viable group to effectively oversee and negotiate with management. I think that a third party, a la the government doing it, will end up creating a bureaucratic apparatus that ultimately I don't think will result. A bureaucratic apparatus that is sometimes maybe politically corruptible and will not result in long-term shareholder value. I mean, I think, it's a... No system is perfect, but I think what's coming out is better than not.
And we're out of time, and we have full phone banks. Producers, this topic needs to be gone over again, because a lot of people are interested in it. Professor, thank you for joining me this morning.
Absolutely. Call me back sometime.
Will do. Charles Elson, Edgar S. Wooller, Jr., Chair of the John L. Weinberg Center for Corporate Governance at Lehmer College of Business and Economics at the University of Delaware. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This program was produced by Rob Schroeder, with on-air production by Rob Schroeder and Jolima Noel. Coming up next hour, asteroids hitting the Earth. Stick around for that. By the way, if you missed part of this program and want to go back and listen to it again, you can do that at WPR.org. Just go to the Kathleen Dunn page and you'll find the link to the audio. Stay tuned. More to come here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today.